Welcome back to The Curious Clinicians, a medical podcast that asks why. I'm Tony Brew, and I'm joined as always by Hannah Abrams and Avi Cooper. Hannah, how are you?
I'm doing great. How are you guys?
Not bad. Avi?
Yeah, this is going to be a salty episode.
Oh, we'll see. We'll see. On that note, for today's episode, we're actually also joined by a fourth party, Jeff Cott, who is currently a critical care medicine fellow at Stony Brook Medicine on Long Island, New York. Jeff completed his nephrology fellowship at Mount Sinai Hospital in Manhattan and is on the executive committee for Neph Madness.
Good to meet you, Jeff.
Thank you for having me on. I'm very excited to be here.
Well, today's episode, as you can probably tell, is a collaboration between our podcast, The Curious Clinicians, and Neph Madness, as well as Things We Do For No Reason. So lots of good things coming together. Jeff, can you sort of give the listeners a bit of background on what Neph Madness is?
Sure. It's a annual online American Journal of Kidney Disease sponsored CME and MOC granting evidence-based learning initiative, which was a little bit of a mouthful, that leverages the tools of social media to teach about the latest breakthroughs in the field of nephrology. It's mirrored after the March Madness NCAA college basketball tournament. So throughout the month of March, 16 hot topics in nephrology, which usually overlap with some other medical specialties, are pitted against each other in one bracket. During March, participants will read posts that have been prepared on each team, fill out a bracket to predict which team will win each matchup, essentially which team people think is the most interesting or relevant, ultimately choosing one topic to win Neph Madness. The winners of each matchup are selected by the Blue Ribbon panel of experts, and their choices are released periodically throughout the beginning to middle of April. It's a fun way to get caught up on a lot of the current information. There's parties and pastries, online debates, expert perspectives. This year, I'm sure, as always, there'll be a little bit of controversy and for even a little bit of comparative physiology for those of you who are interested in learning how animal kidneys work. So there's really something for everyone.
Yeah, I'll never forget the camel kidney year. That was incredible. There was a whole entry on, do you guys remember this? That was like four or five years ago.
Who can forget the camel kidney?
Yeah, but like how do camels maintain osmolality? Well, with wild shifts in how much water they're drinking. It's incredible.
Long loop of Henle's.
So yeah.
That'll yeah. do it, right?
We're big Neph Madness fans here. And Tony, I think we should talk about the other collaborator in this. What exactly is meant by things we do for no reason?
So actually, I'm going to tell you about that in a minute, but I feel like I have to say very, very briefly, the first time I submitted for Neph Madness was a few years ago. Ryan Bonner, who was a chief resident, convinced me and his co-chiefs to submit. And we took it very seriously, read all the posts, like really went through it with a fine-tooth comb. And we ended up being in the bottom fifth percentile in terms of how accurate we were in our bracket. It was quite embarrassing, but more embarrassing for Ryan Bonner, who is now a nephrology fellow, than it was for me. It's hard to come back from that performance, but Neph Madness really is awesome. But so is Things We Do For No Reason. So for those of you who don't know that series, it was started by Lenny Feldman, who's a med peds hospitalist at Johns Hopkins. And Things We Do For No Reason launched in 2015, and it's published in the Journal of Hospital Medicine. And I've been really fortunate to be a co-deputy editor of the series alongside Lenny and Elise Liu. And really the goal for the series, which was inspired by ABIM's Choosing Wisely program, we really aim to review practices that have become common parts of hospital care but may provide little value to our patients, or in some cases, like no value or even negative value to our patients. So Jeff, I think you've got for us two Neph Madness entries that represent things we do for no reason. So like a perfect overlap and perfect marriage. So what do you got?
Yeah, so the first entry is going to be the use of phosphate binders in acute kidney injury. And the second we'll touch on is going to be the urine anion gap in non-GAP metabolic acidosis.
Okay, so why don't we start with phosphate binders in acute kidney injury? So I also am an intensive care physician. I certainly see a lot of AKI in the ICU. Many of our nephrology friends, consultants, they have a list of items that, you know, that they review when sort of making recommendations. And, you know, obviously hyperphosphatemia is often one of them. And so I guess it makes sense to me that you would want to control phosphate levels in AKI, So I guess I'm a little bit surprised to see this as a thing we do for no reason. So what's why is it that?
Yeah, so I think we should start by kind of talking about how hyperphosphatemia develops. And some of this really is going to be kind of from the outpatient chronic kidney disease population. But usually it's a high phosphate load that's coupled with a decrease in your glomerular filtration rate, your GFR, which essentially is going to impair the kidney's ability to clear phosphate. Now, a Western diet is high in phosphorus, things like nuts, dairies, beans, a lot of things that I'm sure a lot of us like to eat. So as soon as one develops a little bit of kidney dysfunction, the phosphate load is going to become a little too overwhelming for our kidneys to handle. This is going to essentially start a hormonal cascade. Now, in the past, parathyroid hormone, PTH, was thought to be the main driver of this. But more recently, fibroblast growth factor 23, which we'll abbreviate as FGF23, which is a phosphatoric hormone that also decreases intestinal absorption, has really become the main player. It's actually the first hormone to rise in the CKD population. Parathyroid hormone does rise eventually, but usually a little bit later in the course. And hyperphosphatemia doesn't actually even usually develop. The main paper that found that FGF23 is the first hormone to rise, in that cohort, hyperphosphatemia was really only present in about 20% of CKD4 patients and 50% of CKD5 patients. So we don't even see hyperphosphatemia until really the late stages of CKD.
Well, that is super interesting. But I guess the first question that comes to mind is, why do we even care necessarily physiologically about acute hyperphosphatemia?
So hyperphosphatemia and the hormonal cascade it triggers is really associated with a lot of adverse events, abnormal bone remodeling, cardiovascular morbidity and mortality. It also worsens acidosis, inflammation, which in an acutely ill patient has negative consequences.
Okay. And I know that in the CKD, chronic kidney disease population, we think it's really important to control hyperphosphatemia. I guess, can you walk through a little bit why we do that and what the evidence shows there?
Yeah. In CKD, the goal is to lower elevated phosphorus. And this is a quote straight from the guidelines, quote, towards the normal range. So that's from the guidelines. There is another metric called the calcium phosphate product, which is exactly what it sounds. You get your chemistry, you take the calcium, you take the phosphorus, you multiply them. And in that, we're kind of looking for a goal less than 55. And in this case, what we're really trying to prevent is vascular calcification, the precipitation of calcium and phosphorus. So approach to treatment, dietary phosphate limitation is really going to be the mainstay. Limiting things, again, such as dairy, cheeses, beans, nuts, which for a lot of people may not be the easiest. And sometimes it's also not enough. So when it's not enough, then we kind of start talking about introducing medications like phosphate binders. Now, phosphate binders, they work as they sound. They bind enteric phosphate. There's a couple different classes, calcium-based and non-calcium-based, and there aren't really many differences. You know, the data shows that they all lower phosphate, though there is one specific medication in the non-calcium-based class, sevelamer, which maybe has a little bit better mortality data compared to the calcium-based phosphate binders. But regardless, patients wind up on, you know, calcium-based, non-calcium-based. The thing about phosphate binders is they need to be dosed with meals. You essentially take one before a meal. It binds a certain amount, not all, but a certain amount of the phosphate that's in that meal, and then that'll be excreted through the GI tract. So if you're snacking throughout the day, the phosphate binder that you took through lunch for lunch is not going to necessarily cover you. You're still going to absorb phosphate from those snacks. And again, the evidence essentially is what we talked about. It lowers phosphate, though we don't really have a true goal for phosphate. We don't have a specific target. We just want to lower it towards the normal range. So even though it lowers phosphate, we don't know that lowering phosphate necessarily changes outcomes. The data is just unclear.
Okay, so that makes sense for CKD, is particularly this idea that you want to prevent like the deposition of these sort of calcium phosphate sort of gloms. But, you know, the topic we're talking about is acute kidney injury. And you alluded to earlier this idea that there's also negative effects on acidosis and inflammation. So does the same hold true ultimately for AKI? Like, do we want to control the phosphate level? And is the use of phosphate binders like going to get us there?
Yeah. So I think it's all, you know, we always want to, you know, control the phosphate level. I think that's true. There are some differences that I think are important to highlight between CKD and AKI in terms of the patients themselves, but also kind of what's causing the AKI. So acutely ill patients tend to be in catabolic states. So they're going to have a net positive phosphate balance. So in that sense, and as Avi alluded to earlier, in AKI patients, a lot of times we see hyperphosphatemia. So it makes sense to pay attention. But the main difference is in AKI, which is going to be occurring a lot in our hospitalized patients, a lot of our hospitalized patients don't have the same oral intake, that same dietary phosphate load that we see in our outpatients. And that's for a couple of reasons. One, in the hospital, we control diets. You know, somebody with a little bit of CKD may come in, we put them on a renal diet. Or somebody who's developing AKI, we can adjust their diet so that the amount of phosphate is less. The other thing is, you know, especially in our critically ill patients, they may be on continuous tube feeds. As we said, binders kind of work in a bolus situation. You take a binder, you eat a meal, it binds some of the phosphate, excretes it. In continuous tube feeds, you're not going to get that same bolus situation because there's a gap of time where you're still getting feeds and the phosphate binder is not going to even be present. So in that case, phosphate binders, there's a little bit of a difference in that their use just may not be as effective. We do know that limitation of dietary phosphate is important. As we said, it still has, you know, in AKI, those effects on, you know, vascular calcification. There is a recent study. There's not a lot of studies on phosphate and AKI, unfortunately, though I think it's probably coming a little bit more in the future. But there's one recent study that used a mouse model that showed that limitation of dietary phosphate did have a positive effect on the hormonal cascade and mitigate some of the inflammation and acidosis that results from hyperphosphatemia. But again, this is maybe not fully translatable to humans because in hospital, we're already controlling diet to some degree, and there just may not be as much of a dietary effect. But even if you wanted to order a phosphate binder for AKI, we also have to talk about if phosphate's coming from an intrinsic source, maybe something like tumor lysis syndrome, or again, that catabolic state that we talked about, the binders are going to be ineffective. And that's because phosphate binders, again, only prevent GI absorption. Something that's coming intrinsically from the body, from cells rupturing, phosphate binders won't even be able to touch. And I will say there's one caveat for this, and I think if you guys allow me maybe to be a little hypocritical and give something that's maybe not evidence-based, this is an incredibly rare situation. It's a callback from my fellowship in a person, young guy who came in with tumor lysis syndrome who still had a very robust appetite. And in this case, tumor lysis syndrome, inherently, we're seeing the adverse effects of hyperphosphatemia because the criteria involve hypocalcemia. So we're seeing that mineralization of calcium and phosphorus. So this is the one rare case where I say, yes, we're going to still control the diet through the phosphate, through the diet. However, in this case, it may be worth throwing on a phosphate binder as long as the individual can tolerate it, just because we're already seeing bad effects. Let's just take as much out of the equation as we can. Now, the last way, phosphate can be removed from dialysis, and the continuous dialysis modalities are actually better than the intermittent from removing phosphate. But in this case, again, it's not one of our acute indications for dialysis. It is something that in tumor lysis, maybe you pull the trigger a little bit quicker just because you're trying to prevent as little phosphate calcium mineralization as you can. But it's not going to be a hard indication like something like hyperkalemia would be.
Okay, so just to quickly recap, it sounds like hyperphosphatemia can be a complication of acute kidney injury, but it is often not being driven by enteric intake of phosphate, and therefore phosphate binders, which are going to bind up, they're only going to bind up what has been taken in, via the gastric route, enterically, may not actually be required and help in acute kidney injury, and really is more of a chronic kidney disease sort of maintenance management. Is it possible that they could be causing harm in this situation if we're using them unnecessarily?
Yeah, certainly. I think like every medication, these have their side effects. The biggest one's probably going to be pill burden. These are pretty big pills. You can look it up on Google if you just search phosphate binders. They're difficult to swallow, and dysphagia, again, is pretty common in hospitalized patients. There's only a specific amount of phosphate that can be bound per pill. So sometimes you have to add 1, 2, 3 pills per patient. So, asking somebody to take 3 large pills can be a little difficult, especially if there's like a dysphagia component. They also have some GI side effects, nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, rarely obstruction can occur. And again, this is a little bit more of an outpatient thing, but I think it's always important to kind of bring medical costs into this. But the cost of phosphate binders, this is from a study from, I think, around 2015, exceeded about $1.5 billion as part of Medicare Part D, which is quite a bit.
That's a lot of money.
Also, Yeah, it's a lot.
It's a lot of money.
So
people like their nuts.
Yes. Yeah. And cheese. I think, and that study actually also showed a decent amount of non-adherence in the outpatient setting, probably for the same reasons that we just talked about.
They sound very difficult to take.
Yeah, they are.
All right. Fantastic. Okay. So I think we have pretty well covered, debunked the idea of FOS binders in acute kidney injury, perhaps with the exception of the my personal favorite reason for acute hyperphosphatemia, which would be tumor lysis syndrome. But let's move on to entry number two, which I'm a little sad to hear about, which is the beloved urine anion gap. Maybe, Jeff, can you walk us through what the urine anion gap is and when we might be using it for unclear potential reasons?
I think we should probably start by talking about the kidney's response to acidosis. And what I want to focus on specifically is the generation of ammonium. So the nephron essentially compensates for acidosis by reabsorbing and generating new bicarbonate. When new bicarbonate is generated, it's going to ultimately be paired with some kind of acid that's excreted. In terms of acid, we have a couple options. First is tetradable acids, which are mostly phosphates, and those are fixed. Those are essentially whatever's filtered through the glomerulus, that's what's going to be there in the urinary space. You can't increase it. So that's number one. And number two is going to be ammonia, which is NH4+. Ammonia, NH3, would be the alternative, but when you add a hydrogen ion acid to it, it's going to become ammonium. So ammonium is generated in the proximal tubules and excreted from the cell into the urinary space. As we head a little bit further downstream into the thick ascending limb of the loop of Henle, ammonium is actually going to be reabsorbed via the sodium potassium chloride cotransporter, which is our transporter that's affected by our loop diuretic. And it's going to be transported actually into the interstitium. This is going to create an ammonium gradient, which will ultimately wind up getting secreted back into the urinary space as distal as we can in the cortical collecting duct. So the end result is that really all free hydrogen protons or acid are going to be bound to ammonia as ammonium, with the remainder bound to the titratable acids that we discussed previously. This results in essentially the excreted acid load really largely being through ammonium. And as the worse the acidosis gets, the more ammonium is going to be generated by the kidneys.
All right, so a normal kidney doing, or set of kidneys, doing what they're supposed to do in response to acidosis, they're going to excrete more ammonium. That's right?
Yeah, correct.
Okay. So I don't know. It seems logical to me that we should just be checking urinary ammonium levels to determine whether the kidneys are working appropriately. So, well, why aren't we doing that?
That would make sense, Tony.
Maybe a thing we should be doing for some reason.
Yes, I completely agree with that. And I think a bunch of nephrologists would. Unfortunately, it's just not widely available. It's time consuming, a little bit difficult to run. There's a manual process to it. So that's why the urine anion gap came about. It's essentially a surrogate test for urinary ammonium levels. And in non-anion gap acidosis, the urine anion gap is going to really help us answer the following question. Is the kidney excreting acid as it should in response to acidosis? If it's not, then it's suggesting that the kidney is at least a partial source of the acidosis.
Okay. The idea of a urine anion gap grew out of the inability to measure ammonium as a way to see if the kidney is appropriately excreting acid in the setting of metabolic acidosis. And if it's not, perhaps that implies a renal tubular acidosis. Okay. And so if we're going to, even though it sounds like maybe this is something that we shouldn't be doing, if you were to endeavor to calculate the urine anion gap, how would you do that?
Yeah. So I will say, I mean, you know, we can always do these things. I think as long as we know the limitations of them, you know, it's, you know, but for academic purposes, it still can be fun to kind of go through all this. But so for academic purposes, we'll say urine anion gap is equal to the urinary sodium plus potassium minus chloride. And kind of quickly going back to that discussion on ammonium generation, the whole idea is that ammonium, a positively charged ion, is going to be paired with chloride, which is negatively charged. So the excess or deficit level of chloride is essentially going to be the surrogate for urinary ammonium. So classically, a negative urine anion gap implies GI losses of alkali as a cause of acidosis. So in this case, the kidney is actually able to compensate. It's going to excrete more ammonium, make more ammonium, and excrete more ammonium. And the amount of chloride is going to increase, making the urine anion gap negative. And the easy mnemonic for that is negative, gut being the GI tract, obviously. Positive implies renal losses. So In this case, not as much ammonium is excreted, so the chloride in theory will be lower, and the urine anion gap is then going to be positive.
In some ways, the urinary or urine anion gap sounds a bit like serum sodium, because like at least the way I sometimes think about it is what we really care about when we're looking at the sodium is osmolarity, but we don't usually routinely check serum osms. Instead, we use the serum sodium as a surrogate for that. We can check urine or serum osms. It's just not part of our routine. And obviously, there's other situations where serum sodium is helpful independently. But this idea of like a surrogate test has value. So then the question becomes like, what's so wrong with the urine anion gap? Why is Hannah going to be quite sad in a few minutes?
It's just so fun.
I'm glad to hear somebody say that. Renal physiology is fun. It really is.
I really like that negative mnemonic. That's very helpful.
Yeah. I learned that one from Joel Toff. He really is guttural when he says it. Guttural.
Oh, have to. Yeah, guttural. Oh, I like that. Punny. We said it's based on assumptions, but that's really where kind of that's its limitations. It's an assumption. The assumption is essentially that there are going to be no other anions in the urine other than chloride. So let's just look at a couple of situations, for example. Now, this isn't the population that you use it in, but if you have a high anion gap, things like lactic acid or ketones, well, those are other acids that will wind up in your urine. Toluene ingestion, which hopefully is not something that we're seeing often, that forms hippuric acid and hippurate when it's metabolized, hippurate being an anion that's excreted into the urine. So again, another anion that winds up in the urine. And going back to the Western diet, we talked about with phosphate, so we might as well talk about it with the urine anion gap. It has potassium salt substitutes, plant-based foods, or other additives with sodium paired with kind of non-chloride anions. And those will also introduce additional anions that are excreted into the urine. Going to a situation where urine anion gap theoretically would be indicated, something like a proximal renal tubular acidosis, that's actually a defect in bicarb reabsorption. So additional bicarb, which is going to be negatively charged anion, is excreted into the urine. And finally, CKD, AKI. When there's a loss of kidney function, urinary ammonium generation is impaired, and you also tend to get impaired reabsorption of other anions like sulfites or organic anions. So there's just a lot of situations where other anions other than chloride wind up in the urine that could theoretically invalidate the urine anion gap.
All right. I apologize to every medical student that I ever asked to help me calculate a urine anion gap. So it sounds like it's got a lot of limitations. It's really intended to be this urinary ammonium detector, but it has a lot of reasons why that might not always work. Is there any data to support using it in clinical settings?
Because of the few labs that really run urinary ammonium, there's not a ton of actual comparative studies out there. There were really only a few that I kind of came across. Various populations going from healthy to chronic kidney disease to kidney stone performers and various population sizes as well. But in all cases, there was no correlation between the urine anion gap and urinary ammonium that was statistically significant. So we just don't have a lot of really solid data in addition to the theoretical limitations that support its use. Unfortunately, it'd be the bearer of bad news. And you know, at some point, hopefully it'll become more widespread. There was actually a Mayo Clinic Laboratories podcast that mentioned, you know, that it's becoming easier. And there was a petition that was signed by many academic and non-academic nephrologists a few years back. So hopefully in the next however many years, we'll start to see all of our hospital labs actually testing for urinary ammonium. Though, do any of your labs have it or?
I've never tried to order it, so I can't say for certain, but I doubt it. Avi Hanny.
I've never tried, but I have also never seen it available. I just love that there was a petition
about this. Yeah.
We're passionate. Nephrologists are a passionate bunch.
That brings me much joy. Much joy.
Yeah.
Well, Jeff, you brought us some, I would say, fantastic entries for Neph Madness that overlap wonderfully with the things we do for No Reason series. I feel like we as a podcast have to make our selections if we were to have a bracket and we were looking at this head-to-head matchup. So what do we think, guys? Who should win between this pairing? What do you think, Hannah?
This is tough. This is tough because whenever I'm thinking about my Nef-Manish choices, it's always, you know, what's got the zeitgeist, right. But then what's got the gravitas? You know what I'm saying? I would consider FOSS binders in AKI to have the zeitgeist here, right? Cost value-based medicine, probably a little more commonly used and a little more low value care that's happening in the average hospital. Urine anion gap has the gravitas. This is debunking something that medical students across the country are very confusedly scribbling down onto papers as we speak, mayhaps. Who could say? So I gotta go urine anion.
Are you gap, filibustering Tony. Right now?
I'm just passionate about this.
So what did you decide?
Oh, a urine anion gap. Yeah.
Okay. Avi, what do you think?
I'm going to go back to that $1.5 billion and just, you know, like, I think we need to try to get that number down. And so, yeah. And so,
the zeitgeist. Yeah.
I also just love this idea of that, like, it's, you know, the urine anion gap, maybe it's not helpful and it does stress out medical students. But the phosphate binder pills are just like unpleasant for patients. And they're not helping and they're expensive. And so
right.
I just think all of those reasons, I'm going to say phosphate binders.
Yeah, I think most of that $1.5 billion is probably CKD and we're not going to make a dent.
I'm sure it is.
We're not going to dent that. But, you know, it's interesting. Initially, I was going to go with urinary anion gap because I want to like see the ammonium assay. But Avi, I think as a patient-centered argument, it's hard to sort of overcome the idea that giving people less pills that are causing discomfort. I'm gonna sort of put that as vote number two for phosphate binders in AKI. Barely over urine anion gap because Jeff, you offered two really fantastic arguments here.
Jeff, are you allowed to have a vote?
Yeah. Well, no, because that's only gonna make it harder because he's gonna vote for urine anion gap. You can tell. Look at his face.
I don't know if that's true. I love my renal physiology, Ooh. But I think the patient-centered care aspect of phosphate binders, I think is, you know, probably would win me over, but I guess, yeah, I can't formally say.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, Jeff, where can
You're
listeners go
to
sort of learn not only more about these two topics, but also about the other topics in Nef-Manish for 2024 and more importantly to submit their own brackets?
Sure. So if you are interested in kind of exploring more Nef-Manish content, you can go to, you can Google Nef-Manish. It should be the first, you know, three links should be, I guess a fairly easy answer, but the first three links should be, you know, Nef-Manish related. The first two being the AJKD blog, which will take you to kind of the overall blog page. And then last year's, which will be updated for this year's Nef-Manish 2024. But if you wanted just a simple link, https://ajkdblog.org/category/nefmadness will be your link. There will be a bunch of blog posts, perspectives, podcasts, on all the other topics. And you can always join in the conversation on Twitter using #nefmadness.
Please tell us how your brackets are doing. Tag us, tweet us. We want to know.
Awesome. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And
thank you for having
me. We'll see how Nef Madness goes. Well, that wraps up another episode of The Curious Clinicians. Thanks, as always, for joining us. Our audio is edited by Claire Morgan of Nodderly, and our producer is Giancarlo Bonomo. You can join our mailing list at curiousclinicians.com to stay up to date on episode releases and have detailed notes delivered directly to your inbox. And you can subscribe to our Substack at thecuriousclinicians.substack.com. And as always, the information contained in this episode is for educational and entertainment purposes only and does not constitute medical advice. Until next time, we've been The Curious Clinicians.